Hey, you guys, this is Christine Blackburn with the Storyworthy Podcast, and I just want to say thank you so much for listening to the show, for going to Stitcher.com and hearing the show. Also, you can hear us, of course, on iTunes and SoundCloud, and the best thing you can do to support our show is to tell your family members, your friends, and your coworkers to tune in to Storyworthy, and that way we can keep the train rolling. Chug-a-chug.
Chug-a-chug.
This episode of Storyworthy is brought to you by GoDaddy.com. You can register your domain name now for only $2.95.
Yeah, that's right. GoDaddy is offering one new or transfer.com for the very low price of $2.95.
Yeah, whether you're starting a new business, you just want to put your idea online, or you just want people to look at you because you need attention, you can make a new .com or you can transfer a .com for only $2.95.
And when you're over there at GoDaddy, enter the code STORY295 in the promo code at checkout, and then you are in fact supporting this podcast.
You'll get what you want. We'll get what we want.
Hey, yo, this is Bryn Hill, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to the Storyworthy Podcast. Here are your hosts, Christine Blackburn and Hannes Finn.
Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm here with
Hannes Finney, and we have taken the Storyworthy mobile van of truth and driven it to Mexico City, the capital of all kidnapping in the world.
Oh my gosh. There is
more kidnapping per capita here in Mexico City. So we're actually, we've tried to disguise the van so that we don't look too, enticing, because people want that Storyworthy money.
Right.
They figure
exactly.
If they kidnap us, they can get at least a coupon.
So Hannes is referring to our topic tonight. Clearly, the topic is a Hollywood kidnapping.
Yes.
And our storyteller tonight, Bryn Hill. Now, he's a writer and a director, and he's very accomplished, Hannes.
He is very accomplished.
And he
has representation up on the 11th floor,
I've heard that. I've heard so much about this 11th floor here
I know,
at Levity
I feel. And by the way, that reminded me of the movie 13th Floor, and Anthony Bench was right. I want to get this on tape.
Okay.
I was wrong. Anthony Bench was right.
Woo, Anthony!
13th Floor did come out the same year or after Matrix.
The Matrix.
And is nowhere near as good.
Anthony said it was a ripoff.
So it was a ripoff. It probably was.
Well, Bryn Hill has come down the stairs to the low lives here.
He doesn't take stairs.
Okay,
you understand? He has representation.
Down the elevator.
His people carried him to the elevator on a silk covered, like King Joffrey would ride in and Game of Thrones, and they brought him down here and deposited. He didn't even walk
and
into this room.
The
they brought him in here and put him into the chair
very
and fluffed up his
that
pillows.
He came down. Now, listen, recently, Bryn Hill, he's a writer and a director and also a cinematographer, but recently he directed the Joss Whedon film called In Your Eyes.
Yes, yes.
Now, listen, you go on Google, you guys, and you Google In Your Eyes, and the trailer, that you can actually get 5 full minutes of it, is so. So I guess it's not even a trailer, is it? It's 5 minutes of the film. It's like the first 5 minutes of the film.
Right. It's more of a sample.
A sample
I would
of the
say.
Film. Yeah, it's on Entertainment Weekly's website. Anyway, it really is amazing. It kind of stops you right
and
in
the Whedon
your
brothers, that's a whole. Those guys are they're on fire.
Their
representation
they are.
Is on the 20th floor of this building.
Well,
that's how high they are.
Well,
their representation
okay.
will not be in a single digit. You understand what I'm saying?
Well, okay. Joss Whedon obviously has a heck of a career, but we're here with Bryn Hill. That's what we're talking
about.
Well,
no, I know, but anybody who's working with those guys.
This film, In Your Eyes, is really the opening scene. You know, there's a child sledding on a hill. And, you hear the children's laughter, and you know something is coming. Right, and then there's this winter scene, and the camera's panning in.
Wait, there's a shark?
Wow, it's really exciting. So anyway, I'm really glad he came down to talk with us. And when he brought forth the topic of Hollywood kidnapping, I'm not really sure where to go with it, but it reminds me of the case.
Yeah, you and I had two different reactions to the phrase Hollywood kidnapping.
Well,
let's hear about yours first.
That movie Alpha Dog, which told the true story of that kid, Jesse Hollywood. And, he was a teenage kid, grew up here in Los Angeles, and he became a drug dealer.
Yeah.
And he kidnapped another kid, just another kid in his class.
Yeah.
And took him up to Santa Barbara and then ordered his killing. And then Jesse Hollywood, this kid, like 18, 19 years old, took off on the run. And they didn't catch him for years, finally catching him in Brazil, His father was giving him money. His father was sending him money.
Fathers,
every month
they're the worst.
To live.
I've said it before, and I'll say it again.
He had a family down there. He had a girlfriend and a child. Anyway, but when I thought about that, I thought, right?
He's got more. He's living the life of Riley.
Yeah, he kidnaps.
That's dating me, by the way. The life of Riley. There's an old saying.
He kidnaps this kid, like just another 17-year-old.
Yeah,
and they, you know, kidnap him, take him up to Santa Barbara. They were
That's
there
where you know that it's some sort of weird faux gangster thing. We're going to kidnap him and take him. Where are you going? South Central? Santa Barbara. We're gonna take him to our villa. We'll show this punk who's boss.
No, but they, you know, went out, hiked out in the woods, hung out with him for days, smoked pot with him, like just like hung out like we're all friends here.
Yeah.
And then this guy, Jesse
that's
Hollywood.
That's what sociopaths do.
Calls
they have no
ahead and says, empathy. Kill him. And they did.
Yeah, exactly. See, now you thought of this very serious
that's
thing.
That's what I was thinking.
When I heard the phrase Hollywood kidnapping, I'm like, is this like get him to the Greek where you're trying to, like, you're with a big time celebrity and you kind of have to do what they say? So it's like you're literally under there. It's like because you're responsible for them, or you have, or you need money from them, or you need something. It's like,
well, if it's your job,
it's your job. It's like, so you know, they're doing unreasonable things, and you have no choice but to go along with them.
Well,
you mean like
as a manager or a friend along on in your posse, as it were.
Well, yeah, but more
and then, like
you know,
watching you do things that are.
I'm thinking like the plot of that very deep movie is that it's his responsibility to get the rock star to the Greek theater. So it's like, you know, you might have a temporary assignment in show business where you're like, or you know, wow, here's, okay, more dating of myself. You know the movie My Favorite Year?
No, absolutely not.
It's from the 80s, stars Peter O'Toole pretending to be Errol Flynn going on your show of shows in the 1950s. The amount of blank stare that I'm getting.
It just sounds like a nightmare. It's just, I mean, everything about it.
It's not in black and white.
Oh, that's
although people in it are dead. By the way, where do you draw the line? Because you can't watch a black and white movie because people are dead in it.
Don't tell Bryn Hill this, please.
I'm sorry.
There's a director sitting right here at the table with us.
He didn't say you act. No, you'll act in it. You don't want to. No, but what about like if it's in color, but you know the person's dead?
Yeah, okay.
That bothers you?
I don't care for that. Yeah,
you don't care for that kind of thing. I want to know Bryn Hill's story because I'm confused as to what we are. You know, we don't know exactly what it is, which I think is good.
But again,
you know what it is? It's intriguing.
It is intriguing. It's compelling, yes. And it's intriguing. I recently was told that your story can't just be interesting; it needs to be compelling. So there has to be like a come hither sense to.
I prefer stories that are neither compelling nor intriguing. It's well, like, hey, yeah, I was crossing the street and nothing happened to me. There were no incidents. I didn't lose any money. I wasn't hit by a bus.
All right, you guys. Bryn Hill is here right now, and he's got a story, Hannes, as you know, called A Hollywood Kidnapping. So we're not quite sure what's going to happen.
We're going to find out whether Hollywood or kidnapping is more important in the title.
Yeah, exactly. But before we bring on our storyteller, folks, if you'd like to support Storyworthy, that would be grand. Am I right?
Right. You could do it in a number of ways. First, go to storyworthypodcast.com. You can click on the Amazon ad, which allows you to shop normally, and we get a little bit of a taste.
That's a
nice
thing to
do. You can donate money to us directly if you want to.
That's always fun. And also, folks, don't forget to listen to us on Stitcher Radio. Stitcher Radio has a free app, and it is the best way to listen to podcasts, honestly.
It is the best, easiest. And you know what? Tell your friends.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Just tell people. Tell them it's not as hard as they think it is. Tell them podcasting is like radio. Translate it into what people understand.
Yeah, don't be afraid. It's just words coming out of a microphone.
Right, that went into a microphone.
That's right.
We
exactly.
hope.
Exactly. All right, you guys, and don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Storyworthy. Wherever you are, folks, stay tuned because Bryn Hill is on his way here. On Storyworthy, we have entrepreneur Cheryl Schumann.
And I'll be talking about how I became the Martha Stewart of marijuana.
Woohoo! Next time on Storyworthy.
This is Jim Beaver from Deadwood, and you cocksuckers are listening to Storyworthy.
Back, ladies and gentlemen. Unfortunately, we don't know exactly where we are because we have been kidnapped, ironically enough, and we have hoods over our heads. We assume we're still in Mexico somewhere, perhaps. I hear the name Yasiel Puig being thrown about.
Good news is we can always kick out the taillights here in the car and then wave, you know, I can wave my T-shirt out of the back of the car.
Yeah, I think that happens a lot in Mexico. I don't want to be all, you know, like, but there's a lot of clothing flying out of cars in Mexico. That's what I hear.
You know what always sort of makes me laugh on is when you see somebody who is in their car, like, ahead of you or whatever, and their belt, like the belt to their coat is sticking out of the car
door. Oh, right, and bouncing
and
along.
Why does that make me laugh?
I don't know. It shouldn't be that funny. Yeah. I mean, I've seen like the seatbelt lying out of the car, and that's like, oh, that's funny. Oh, they're going to die.
No,
but
I like it.
You're talking about the belt of a coat.
Be a clothing part, I think, is the funnier way.
Or like the sleeve of a very expensive cashmere sweater being dragged 70 miles an hour along on the Santa Monica Freeway. You're like, you're going to be unhappy.
Oh. All right, you guys. He's here right now. Bryn Hill is a writer and a director, also a cinematographer, who recently directed the Joss Whedon written and produced independent film In Your Eyes. Now, this film, Hannes, made its world premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival just a couple of months ago in April.
That's one of your best film festivals right there. That's the top of the line.
Well, it's really interesting what this film did and what Joss did. He self-distributed the film online instead of taking on the theatrical distribution. So you can actually get this film right now via a Vimeo distribution for $5. So like they premiered the movie and then they said, and you know what? If you want to tell your friends about it,
it's a whole new world.
Go home and watch it right now.
Look, they got TV shows. I just coming in here, I just saw a big billboard for a TV show starring John Goodman on Amazon.
Interesting. So
it's like
this
is like the top of the, you know, this whole broadcast thing, this whole distribution thing. It's all changing. That's what I'm saying.
Lunatics,
you heard it here first.
The lunatics are running the asylum.
Wait a minute. You heard it here last. I'm the very last person to realize that
all right,
things
you guys,
are changing.
You can find Bryn Hill on Twitter at Bryn Hill. That's B-R-I-N-H-I-L-L. And wherever you are, folks, please put your hands together for Bryn Hill.
The names in this story have been changed to protect the guilty. So a while back, I directed a short film that got a little shine, won a special jury prize at the Sundance Film Festival and a bunch of other accolades around the globe. For the unindoctrinated, there's this phenomenon in Hollywood of what I like to refer to as a genius meeting. These are general meetings where a producer or a studio executive has read or seen something a filmmaker's done and wants to meet. So they get to know what makes you tick and probably to make sure you don't dress like Crisscross or are taken to randomly insulting strangers or a Neanderthal or something else unseemly. In my experience, this executive will invariably call you a genius at some point in the conversation and give you a bottle of water as a parting gift. Many industry folks call it the Avion Tour. Rarely is a job at stake. It's more of a look to a future relationship. So I was deeply rooted in genius status because of this short film, doing an extended water bottle tour. The only thing about my particular tour was that everyone I seemed to meet with got fired or left their job almost immediately after I sat in their office, and in one particular case, the very same day I sat in their office. It was like I was a genius cooler, or the filmmaking version of Clooney's Ryan Bingham in Up in the Air, the straight-up studio executive executioner. To make matters worse, I had made a short film, a money-losing proposition if there ever was one, and I had a wife who had literally just graduated public policy law school 5 days after giving birth to our daughter, so I needed a gig, like, now. And I needed someone who still had a job to give me one. One morning, I'm eating Goya black beans for breakfast because I'd bought a case of them with my $20 residual check from the short film playing on cable, and the phone rings. My agent, got a genius meeting for you. It's today. But if you play your cards right, there's money here. Cash money? Hell, I'm in. Wait for it. Here comes the caveat. It's going to be a drive, though. Now, by drive, he didn't mean I had to putter my 88 Saab 900 with its ceiling liner pillowing down across the seats like a nomad's tent out to Universal or Warner's or some other place over the hill, which was emasculating enough when you have to park my car that had been graffiti tagged back in Brooklyn next to the hottest new luxury vehicles owned by studio types, but rather to some place called the Inland Empire. This is where Dwayne takes all his meetings, I was told. Now, Dwayne is a Grammy-winning, multi-platinum-earning musician-turned-actor who co-starred in a number of massive hits that made literally billions of dollars collectively. So he's got dough and a dream. What he really wants to do is direct. And he needs a writer, a quote-unquote genius writer. Someone like you, Bryn, says the agent. Traffic sucks. I literally take six freeways. It's 110 degrees. I'm watching the water gauge on my flaccid Saab because the thing's threatening to overheat and I don't have air conditioning. So I'm sweating like an extra on the set of Ishtar. And after about 3 hours in the car, I spot my exit. And I'm cruising off it when, oh no, you gotta be kidding me. I hammer my horn, but this clown show with his cell phone pressed to his ear and Jesse Pinkman's Toyota Tercel switches lanes without looking and bam. We limp off into a gas station to exchange information. I check my front end, bumpers literally hanging off the car like some kind of guillotine waiting to drop. Pinkman gets out of his car in total hysterics. And not because of the accident, mind you, but because he's breaking up on the phone with his already married boyfriend. As he hands me his insurance card, he asks me if I like his shirt. His boyfriend doesn't like it and broke up with him over breakfast because of it. And do I think that's fair? Look, I'm sympathetic to your whole situation, bro. It seems painful and all, but I'm going to be late to Dwayne's, I tell him. And I quickly steal twine off a stack of newspapers to affix my bumper back to its hood. I check the agent's directions. Drive 8 miles on Whisper Lane all the way out past the wineries. There's no addresses, but you'll know when you find it. Really? How? Psychic hotline? I drive the winding roads, my bumper scraping anytime we hit a pothole, passing really nice wineries and some not so nice, what may or may not be meth cooking lab trailers. And after about 10 miles, I'm pretty sure I missed the place. But then I see it, like a mirage, an airbrushed sign hidden in the trees on the side of the road with fancy script announcing Wayne's Palace ahead, accompanied by a really groovy looking arrow. Another airbrushed sign, Wayne's Palace, in big letters. A place like no other, in smaller letters. I follow the arrow onto a dirt road. It eventually empties onto a half-finished driveway, going straight up what is virtually a cliff. I test the outer reaches of my clutch, limp to a stop a quarter of a mile later in an unfinished roundabout in front of a white McMansion with untilled soil for landscaping. The whole thing sitting on top of a mountaintop overlooking a winery. I fold out of my car and I start to change. Now, I was smart enough to wear driving clothes in the heat, and now I'm putting on my power shirt, matching pants. Ah! I yell. I look over my shoulder and there's a statue of a gargoyle with smoke coming out of his mouth. Wait, that's not a statue. That's a dude crouched on a wall smoking a giant blunt. And he stares at me through bloodshot, stony eyes and he says, Gia. Gia to you. Two. Here to see Dwayne, I say with my shirt off. Got an appointment? Yep. 10:30 a.m. I might be a touch late because it's been a whole thing. He isn't listening. He just takes one look at my plunging bumper and ambles into the house. I glance around. It's like the parking lot of a studio lot here. Mercedes, Rolls, Rangy, Beamer. Only all the cars are white and they're parked around the driveway in an organized semicircle. The doors to the four-car garage are open, but no vehicles are inside. But there is, however, a massive airbrushed painting running the length of the entire back wall, some 60 feet. It's a reenactment of the Last Supper, only Marvin Gaye is depicted as Jesus. And other deceased, recognizable musicians are his 12 apostles, like Roy Orbison's John and Tupac's Simon Peter. It really makes no sense. And written in giant letters below it is, Art by Larry Shepard, Concept by Dwayne. You got an appointment? I turn to see a stunning model, like supermodel stunning, standing in the dirt and pumps and barely wearing a bikini. I nod, oh God, she mumbles, and suddenly five pit bull puppies run out of the house and surround her yapping. You got an appointment? I turn to see Dwayne crossing the dirt and only boxers and shower shoes. He steps onto a small wall and starts to tug on sweats. Here we are in his driveway, me quickly buttoning up my power shirt and him pulling on sweats. Yep, with you, 10:30, Chuck said it. Oh, the writer. The writer. The writer. This here's the writer. The gargoyle cackles. Is he going to be the new crazy bitch? Everyone laughs. The model who's fighting off the pit bull puppies, the gargoyle who's lighting up another blunt, and Dwayne in his sweats. Let's get started, Dwayne says, and he waves me into the house. He unlocks and relocks a back door, and we enter a rec room that is literally being converted to look like a mini version of the bullpen in Office Space. Four generic white cubicles and a copy machine. I look up, and there's an airbrush sign that reads Office in fancy script above the door jamb. Dwayne and I cram into one little cubicle, and he flips open a laptop, and I start to make small talk about a mutual friend who directed him in a movie, you know, like I would in a genius meeting, looking to show that I don't dress like Crisscross, I don't randomly insult strangers, and I'm not a Neanderthal. But he cuts me off with, look, I don't like to get all buddy-buddy with directors, you know. Now, I need you to read this. And he's gone in a flash, just like that. And I'm in a cubicle by myself, and I read, for a couple hours, a script. A script that isn't really a script, but more of a series of unconnected scenes. It's all over the place. It's at once a comedy, a tear-jerking drama, an action film, a sci-fi vehicle, and possibly part of it's animated. But not in a good One Crazy Summer kind of way, but in some other very confused kind of way. But look, it's not my first rodeo. So I spend an hour trying to formulate an opinion on what it wants to be and how to make it work as something real, and then I set out to look for Dwayne. But really, I'm just kind of looking for a bathroom because at this point, it's been about 7 hours since I left my house. And beyond that, I could really use a bottle of water. The Avion tour. I'm in a hallway. Every room has an airbrush sign on the door. Wayne's bedroom, Wayne's linen closet, Wayne's studio, Wayne's guest room, and most importantly, Wayne's bathroom. Thank God. When I come out, a dude I haven't seen before wanders by. "You the new crazy bitch?" he asks. I don't know what he means, so I ask if he knows where Dwayne is. Try the studio. So I go in the studio, and Dwayne's in there indeed recording a song for Mother's Day. And the gargoyle's the sound engineer, and the song is good. Dwayne asks on the mic if I read it. I nod. He tells me to hang out. He's singing, and I sit there unmoving like a statue thinking, man, I could really use that bottle of water right about now. I should have drank out of the faucet in the bathroom. 2 hours later, he's happy with his track, and we go outside to play with the pit bull puppies. And I start to tell him how I'd fix his script and... as one of the puppies sort of gnaws on my Nikes, and he stops me. "I can't really wrap my head around this. You know, what you're saying?" He announces, "I need you to write it down." So back to the cubicle go, and I figure, this is the job my agent was talking about, right? There's money here. I'm a genius. Dwayne's directing. All signs are pointing north. So I bang out a rough treatment in like an hour, and I go to leave the cubicle, but the door is locked from the outside. Shit. I knock. I shout. I knock some more. I'm getting nervous. I try the back door, also locked. There's an open window, but that seems ridiculous to me, so I start banging for like a solid 10 minutes before the thing finally opens on a guy in a chef's outfit standing in the hall. "Oh, hey, didn't know you were in here," he says all casual. "Are you the new crazy bitch?" Now, I've got to know who the hell this so-called crazy bitch is and why I'm the new him or her. Aside from changing clothes in the driveway, which in fairness is a little nutty, I've done nothing remotely crazy in my 7+ hours in this house except for maybe being too shy to ask for the requisite bottle of water for this genius meeting because I'm dying of thirst now. Dwayne's not in the studio. He's in the pool with a trainer. The supermodel's in a corner surrounded by pit bull puppies. The guy from the hallway is reading The Watchman at a table, ignoring her plate. The chef disappears, and I'm standing there watching Dwayne swim laps. And I could drink the entire pool right now. I'm that thirsty. And Dwayne comes up for air, and he says, "Go." I'm sorry. "Huh? Me? What, like now?" So I start pitching him my changes, and he can't really wrap his head around them either, and he asked me to go write a scene. Okay, this is really the job now. This has to be the job. So I follow my breadcrumbs back to the cubicle, and this time, putting a giant box on the door to prop it open, I write. I write my ass off, and I print it, and I march back upstairs, and there are three dudes sitting around a TV playing some motocross game on PlayStation. "You the new crazy bitch?" one of them asks me. I shrug, I guess. They tell me to sit down. I do. And above the TV is an airbrushed painting. It's Marvin Gaye stepping off a throne, placing his crown on Dwayne, who is kneeling before him. "The future music crown is past," fancy script reads at the top, and the backdrop is the Matrix Green Digital Rain. At the bottom, it reads, "Art by Larry Shepard, concept by Dwayne." They got a whole thing going on, these two. Maybe it's a whole cottage industry I don't know about. "New crazy bitch, you want to play?" one of the guys asks. "Sure," I shrug, "but I really just want water." We play for a couple hours because Dwayne is out running. He's training for a new role, getting in shape. As we sit there and pass the time, I daydream about being on set with this megastar as he directs his award-winning masterpiece, written by yours truly. It's gonna be great. "Let's do it." Dwayne breaks me from my daydream, and I jump up and I tell him, "I love the Matrix airbrush. It was my concept," he says without a hint of irony. "Let's hit the kitchen." Thank God, food. We sit in a booth, me, him, the gargoyle, all on one side and the supermodel on the other. "Glad you got some lunch," Dwayne says to me. "You should be ready to go now." "Wait, lunch? Didn't get that memo." The gargoyle hands out pages to us, the scenes I wrote. And we start to act them out, the four of us, in the kitchen booth, while the chef drinks a 32-ounce big gulp and preps dinner. I've never been closer to a beverage I wanted more. Now, I've been gone from home for 15, 16 hours here, and 12 or 13 of those in this house, and we're acting, and I'm the weak link. The gargoyle is surprisingly good, fantastic even. I'd highlight him in the review. And then the chef steps in with a folded piece of paper like an assistant does for an executive in a meeting. Dwayne must have seen that with a studio head or something, I think. And Wayne reads it, and then he looks at the chef with confusion. "Wait, do you need paper? Because this piece has an old note on it," he says. "Oh, I thought I'd recycle, you know, for the environment," the chef replies. "But then everyone can see the note," Dwayne says, "because, you know, it's on the back." Now, wait, I don't understand what you're doing anyway. And he goes, well, I'm going down the hill for supplies to make dinner, the chef says, revealing what the note says now for all of us to hear. Okay, says Dwayne, before launching back north, seeing you go. Now, we must have workshopped this for at least another hour and a half because the chef goes and comes back with loads of groceries. And when he returns, Dwayne finally explains the job. I like what you wrote. It's good. Great scenes. Here's the deal. I had a writer living here. She would write a scene, bring it to me. We'd workshop it, and then she'd go back and rewrite it. So it was like a round-the-clock kind of thing. That sounds crazy, I half-whisper. Yeah, she was crazy, he says. So I'm supposed to replace the crazy bitch, who it turns out might have actually been sane, and I'm supposed to move in here. Look, I'm accommodating. I can play with others. But I'm already going on 16 hours here, and I feel like I've been kidnapped by a Hollywood star, and I need to get out, like, now. You're staying for dinner, right? Dwayne says generously. We got some people coming by, and you should stay. You might meet your future wife. Dwayne, or Wayne, I have a present wife and a baby I kind of need to get home to, I say. Oh, he says, genuinely disappointed. I like you. You're a good dude. Kind of a genius. Let me think on this. I mean, you got a baby, so you probably can't live here because we're not really set up for a baby. You know what? Hang out a while I think on it. Cool. I shrug. He leaves with the gargoyle. I look at the model and I'm like, straight up, is he coming back? And she shakes her head no. Could I have a bottle of water, you know, for the road? I bravely ask the chef and he gives me a one and I wind my way down to the front door. It's locked. I can't unlock it. I try another door, locked. And I remember the window, my window. I go back to the cubicle and I write a note thanking Dwayne and I climb out the window. My car is virtually buried by a fleet of new cars that have appeared for dinner. Now, one detail I failed to mention is my sock didn't reverse at the time. So I would often drive around looking for a parking spot I can pull into and out of without reversing, but in my angst and fear to get here on time, I'd forgotten this little detail. Now, I can't, in good faith, go back in there and ask them to move cars around, so I put the thing in neutral and I start pushing it around in a 14-point turn. I suddenly look up. The gargoyle's watching me, and before I know it, he's silently helping. And when we get the thing going the right way, he says, you know, it's not for everyone. And before he just disappears back into the house. Now I take off, winding my way back down the hill, my great escape. I down the water bottle in one chug and pull into a Taco Bell. And I count out literally all the change in my car and strategically order. There are moments in your career in the arts where you're sort of down to your last resources. And I've heard stories of people packing up to leave this town and then the studio called with a TV deal the very day they were leaving. This kind of felt like my moment of truth. Would I give up on it before I ever truly started? The Taco Bell manager comes over to my table and she tells me she feels sorry for me watching me count out pennies and nickels to grub and she gives me a free 89-cent burrito. What do you do? She asks casually. I'm a filmmaker, I reply. Sounds cool. Bet you have good stories. I smile and my cell rings, my agent. How'd it go? He wants to know. I could tell him so many things, but I tell him the truth he needs to hear. It went great, man. Fantastic. Listen, we got a commencement check for you. P. Diddy wants you to write a TV show for him. You start tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
I'm dying to know.
To protect the guilty.
I know, but I'm dying to know this.
You guys will have to go out there and try to guess.
And you're not going to tell us.
Can't tell you.
It sounds like almost like a Phil Spector thing, you know, who lived up in his own little crazy reality mansion.
But I think a lot of people do that. It's like they get an insane amount of money, and I don't know if people like don't want to think about how it could all go away or how much luck was involved, but they think that something has to be happening 24 hours a day. Like all these projects are happening at once, all these people are here,
of importance.
The more money I get, the fewer people are coming to my house. Well, that's the way I am.
This guy was very much like a working class guy before he hit it.
No, he's working, but
he was working class, you know, like as a youth, as a kid. Yeah. So like he grew up blue collar and then he got this taste and he grew up in LA and he moved as far away as he could, which was he found this little mecca out in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
And brought everybody who was important to him. So like he had writers living in his house just writing stuff.
Which wouldn't be that bad if they told you that was what was going to happen.
Yeah, there was no heads up on that. Yeah. There was no job description.
I like the gargoyle, by the way. I think that's a new superhero where he sits and smokes weed and then helps people move their cars.
Up on the side of a wall.
Yeah, like Batman.
The reason I thought of him is he had braids, so he sort of had this whole like gargoyle thing going. Like he had his hair braided up and And he just was like always crouching on this wall. It was like his little
safety, his nook.
Yeah, his little nook, his little like safe spot.
There's this area in LA, and it's called the Circle of Mansions, and it's between like where the 5 and the 118 intersect. And there is literally like 18 mansions in a big circle, mostly of, I don't know why, Indian descent. I'm not sure why that is, but we would shoot commercials up in those huge,
sort of like
homes.
Behind Simi Valley,
right, up on this hillside where you could hear the traffic. But then people would go up and they'd put like these Grecian columns in front of their house, and you know, gargoyles and lions at the ends of their driveways, and make this fantasy land that only those 18 homes could enjoy. I mean,
yeah, there was nobody else there. Yeah, I don't know what that.
I mean,
I don't
know what the craziest part about, you know, Wayne's palace is that you only could experience it if you got invited to it.
Right. And it's just the one man. Did he have a family? Did he have children?
No, he just had all these people
just
living there.
Just the model.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, who knows how many models.
And you
kept meeting new characters. I mean, I condensed it. I mean, there were like characters coming in and out, and they all referred to me as the guy, the new crazy bitch.
And you could do, this is easily a short film, like a
short film. This is an epic miniseries on HBO. This can go on for
years.
This
may be the longest story worthy
story
literally,
you've
ever had.
What? I just realized you literally just lived the Hotel California. You can check out anytime you want, but you can never leave.
It's true. Depending on how many Jamesons you buy me, that story can get longer and longer and longer.
Is that your drink, Jamesons?
Well, you know.
Well, you sure you don't want a very small Caesar salad instead of a Jameson?
It's an Irish whiskey, isn't it?
It is an Irish whiskey.
Yeah.
It's the Irish whiskey.
It can take you south, not north sometimes.
I love when people say, oh, no, but this whiskey's really smooth. You won't even feel it. And I think, well, first of all, if I don't feel it, why am I drinking this? Or if I can't taste it. But also, anytime they say it's really smooth, it's on fire in my mouth. Like, I've never had a whiskey that I'm like,
I know.
You know?
I'm not a whiskey guy. I've never had one where I'm like, oh, this was an enjoyable
that was
experience.
Satisfying, yeah.
Yeah.
It's always like fire.
My problem is I don't really drink that much. And so then when I do, you know, I'll have more than, you know, my share of Jamesons. And then that's like a whole thing.
And that's
I'm like that. I'm a lightweight. It's
it's like a whole situation.
Yeah.
So, the Irish blood just takes over. And it's just.
Yeah.
You didn't get paid anything for all of that time.
No. That was, no, I actually
barely
paid
got
to
a bottle
go there
of water.
Because I'd
your
used
gas,
all of my change out
your
of my
Taco
car.
Bell experience.
Yeah. I mean, I was not exaggerating. Like, literally, I was counting out pennies. And
I love
that. Like,
that
math.
Is the kicker. The sympathy of the Taco Bell manager. Like, here's a free burrito.
Yeah.
I was and like, she's looking at your car as like, you're a homeless guy.
Well, yeah, I'm
somehow
like,
traveling across
the
desert.
Empire where, you know, there's this weird mix of like, and it is that. There's this the town I was in. There's like wineries and it's beautiful and people go there to spas and stuff, and then there's like this other side of the tracks that's on there.
Yeah, when you come
like
back,
even in the gas station there's this whole side narrative I spared you guys on, but the characters who came over to like get involved in my car situation, like telling me how I can fix
no
the car,
you're right
like,
because out there in the
they're
desert
locals.
I came
and
back
and
once
these guys,
from,
and this lady felt sorry for me,
yeah,
like imagine
yeah.
the other people coming.
I came
to
back from
Taco Bell.
Big Bear once down the far side of the mountain,
right,
and you end up in this town and you're like, I don't know what year it is. It's like 1930, and it's like everybody – it's like you, white trash is an insulting term for it, but it's just like very lower class or lower class, very decent people, but like no money.
Well, it's
I mean,
just also
no
the fact that
money.
It's like they don't even know Los Angeles is an hour away. You know what I mean? They're not even aware that the city exists. It's such a desolate place. Like sometimes people think California is all, you know, Hollywood and everybody's in the know. But really, half the state is rural
I feel
as
that time,
Kansas
whenever,
or Nebraska.
Whenever you go to the high desert, I feel like these people live in a different universe than I do.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I
want to ask
do.
You a question. I'm looking at your IMDb page, The Ecology of Love, a short that you directed in 2004, starring Pharrell Williams,
yes.
who is now ubiquitous with his song Happy.
With giant
from Despicable
hats.
Me. Yeah, with the enormous hat. So I had no idea he was ever an actor.
Did he wear a hat back then?
He did not. The irony being that he did not even want – he was not into hats then, so his character did not wear a hat.
How tall is he? Is that
Pharrell?
Man? Yeah, Pharrell. I'm just curious.
That's a good question. He's tall.
Because with a hat, there's
with
more.
With a tall, there's more to him, yeah. I mean, he's not a short man.
Now, you've worked with a lot of interesting people like Melissa Leo, Rosanna Arquette, Nick Cannon. And so – and because you have been directing films for how long?
For a while? Yeah, I mean, I went to film school, so I did some films there. I did a short with Maya Rudolph in film school.
Oh, I love her. What film school?
It was awesome. I went to NYU.
Yeah, how exciting.
You may have heard of it. And then I went to work for Spike Lee, who was one of my professors. So
that was
cool,
exciting.
Which is kind of cool.
What was the class you took from him?
I think he was teaching like
how to be a crazy bitch. I believe that was the name of the class.
How to be a crazy bitch. Yeah. How to survive your meetings in Hollywood later. No. Yeah. Directing, of course, because it's Spike.
Okay, right. Oh, I'm
but
sorry.
But Spike's class was awesome because he would bring in, like, everyone he works with. Like,
wow.
Scorsese came to our class and just, like...
Oh, that's awesome.
And just talked. Like, he and Spike just talked. It was the coolest thing. Or, like, you know, every actor, this like, Spike would bring in Turturro, whoever, you know, like,
how
whoever
exciting.
He could get, whoever was in New York, whoever he could get, whoever he could talk into coming.
And
it was
where
really
did you
cool.
grow up?
I'm a weird hybrid. I did... Boston, born in Boston until I was 12, and then moved to Venice, Santa Monica when I was 12.
Oh, I see. So you really grew up in California. So show yeah. business isn't outside the realm.
Not
of...
outside the realm. I was, yeah, but, you know, dumb enough to go into it, I guess.
Oh, now come on now.
Smart enough to yeah. go into it.
As
or
a
desperate
director.
For the attention of
but
strangers.
But then, I would flip-flop. I couldn't decide East Coast, West Coast. Back and forth,
and you still
back
and go
forth.
Back and forth, it sounds
I do,
like.
For work and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, but it's easier to live out here. Do you not agree?
I love it.
California.
Yes.
I mean,
how
in
can
New
you
York,
go wrong?
It seems like
I
unless
know.
You have a tremendous amount of money in New York, you're not going to have a window that opens.
New York's tough.
You
New
might
York's
not
tough.
Own a couch.
I had a moment, you know, I would go there right when I had first moved back to California. I would go back and I would stay with my friends, and they had young children. And so I would go with them to take them to preschool yeah. in the dead of winter. And I was like, this. Taking them and putting them in the stroller and yeah. the whole
and
wraparound thing.
Right,
stroller,
it's like
and
a Christmas story. You put
them
in the
subway stop.
It's a lot
yeah.
of work.
And then you get on the subway and no one will give you a seat and they won't let the stroller on. You know, like, I was like, how do people do this? This is nuts.
Yeah.
I think with a certain amount of money, you know, you could do it. But
life gets really easy.
Well, with a certain amount of money, you're paying somebody else to take your kids to school.
So let me ask you, this movie, In Your Eyes, like I said, I watched the beginning of it and it's just fascinating. I love it. And Joss wrote the movie?
Joss wrote the movie and executive produced it, and I came on to direct it.
And so it follows these two kids, Dylan and Rebecca. They live on opposite sides of the country, but they somehow sense what the other person is feeling.
Most of the movie takes place with them as adults, and they can experience each other's senses. So
a little bit of supernatural
so there's
going
a, it's
on.
A, it's basically what Joss does with everything, which is... With everything he writes, he kind of takes two genres and mashes them up. And so in this case...
Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Yeah, I mean,
boom.
Name anything, Firefly, whatever.
Toy Story, The Avengers.
All of them. It's like
Toy
there's
Story.
A mashup going on some yeah. level. And so in this, it's sort of a love story and metaphysical, and then they're mashed together to be like a supernatural romance or a metaphysical love story, depending on how you want to qualify it. But, you know, it's funny. Like this, the thing that I responded to with it was it's really... like Avengers or any of Joss's stuff, it's like about these two loner heroes who kind of have to band together to overcome adversity and like figure out their calling, which is no different than a superhero movie. It just happens to take place in sort of a love story setting.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you're casting this sort of thing, do you as the director have any say in the casting process? Because this must have been a very special actor and a very special actress that you needed to cast for this.
Yeah, I mean, with this, it was like we would all sort of brainstorm ideas together.
You mean like your dream actor?
Yeah,
like
well, there's some of that. And then there's, you know, like with any of these things, when there's money and there's a movie, you kind of go around, for those who don't know, you go around to these agencies, right? You go around to the agencies and the agencies pitch you people. Like they say, what do you think about so-and-so? Or what do you think about this person? And what's interesting about Bellwether Studios, which is Joss Whedon and Kai Cole formed this micro budget sort of micro studio.
Yeah.
And the notion behind it was to do whatever they want, any kind of stories they want to do. And the one cool thing about it is they didn't really care about names. Like in a lot of ways, Joss was kind of the name because he has such a two-way conversation with his fan base. So we would just sit around the four of us, Michael Roif being the other person, the other producer on it. And we would just spitball ideas and then we would meet people and, that was sort of how Zoe Kazan came about being
how
in the
exciting.
Film. Yeah, it was just like Joss had seen her in a movie called what he calls Splody Girl, which is Exploding Girl, this indie. And I had seen her in stuff, and Michael had seen her in stuff, and Kai had seen her in things. And we all really liked her. And when we met with her, she was just perfect. I think we met over muffins.
Nobody pitched you.
Wait a minute.
Joss
there was no
her.
Blunt involved
no blunt
in it. No one was the crazy bitch
Joss
at this
saw
meeting.
Her, though. He saw her first called that agent.
Yeah, he had seen her. And yeah, we Michael Roif or Kai or somebody called up the agent and said, we want to meet Zoe.
And they said, okay.
And we said, okay. And then Michael Stahl David, who stars in the film and was the star of Cloverfield, he actually auditioned.
Oh, that's great.
And he was amazing in his audition. He was like the one kid who came in and just nailed it.
And
was
so
like,
once
perfect.
You get these guys cast, do you just, as a director, do you just try to stay out of their way? Or how much input do you like to give as a director? Or it depends, I suppose.
I think it just depends on the moment. You know, it's like what's great about Zoe and Michael is, and also my style is I like to get options and like they will give you different looks. So you do it one way and it's like they weren't adverse to, hey, will you try it this other way? And so that kind of allows you some leeway in the edit room to really find an amazing moment or find an amazing performance. And I steal stuff. Mm-hmm. Like I'll steal moments between takes of them, like waiting for them to adjust lights and stuff.
So
there's
really?
Like little weird quiet moments. I do that in all my movies.
Well, we've actually been taping you since you got out of your car this morning, Bryn. And so we're going to use these awkward moments.
These weird awkward moments.
I heard you in the bathroom a little earlier.
Yeah, we had this thing where I was going to ask you about, so you're saying you're continuing to run the camera even by stealing moments, filming people.
Yeah. Sometimes just little moments because you can kind of find really nice little cutaway moments that are emotional or whatever, and then some of those are in the film.
Well, now, like when they're making out in the dressing room.
Yeah,
for example.
Yeah, snorting coke. You know,
no,
of course,
they never
it's Hollywood.
They never did.
But Clint Eastwood would do a thing where he would like just kind of shoot. He would say, "Okay, we're going to rehearse this." And he would shoot the rehearsal,
and
then he would go, "Okay, that's it, we got it."
Yeah,
people are completely relaxed.
I've heard
when
that he does not even call action and does not call cut. He just says go and stop.
Could he be cooler?
He's pretty cool.
I don't know
who else gets away with that, but away with it, which is kind of cool. And I imagine his set is like a super mellow Zen set.
Yeah, we've talked to people who've been on there.
He's like 6'3" he's tall and he just it's like Bill Clinton on set.
And he probably works like 6-hour days.
And what was the
sounds amazing.
Dan Satchoff, your old partner from USA TV, was on the show, and he was in J. Edgar Hoover. I say he just walked in, you know, they're in this little room, and all of a sudden Clint Eastwood comes in, and he's like, his eyes are watering because he has allergies, and it's just, walks in, the first thing he says is there a goddamn lion in here? You're like, yes! And he goes, okay, go. And they do the scenes, like, do it again. Okay, great. That was it. That was it.
And there, we're moving on.
It's like, if I cast the right guy, and that's one of the things I've always heard about directing, it's like, it's 90% casting. If you put the right person in there,
so much of it is that. And then, you know, it just depends. Like with this film, Ball Don't Lie, I did, we cast an actual basketball player as the lead. And part of the reason was we wanted the basketball stuff to feel authentic. And with him, it's like I actually worked with him for a couple of years to kind of get him to be where he needed to be. And then you're still kind of coaxing and coaching because he's not trained. I mean,
that kid?
When he did it, he was probably... You know, he was early 20s, but he was playing high school.
And that is from the novel Three Stones Back.
Well, that was the original title. It's actually, the novel is Ball Don't Lie.
Okay. Oh, I see. Also,
which is an acclaimed YA novel, sort of reluctant readers, boy readers love that book. And girl readers love it, too.
Reluctant readers, I like that.
In the movie In Your Eyes, what kind of camera did you use on that?
We shot with the Alexa, which
that's small.
Well, it's relatively small. I mean, with film lenses and stuff, it gets bigger. But yeah, I mean, because of there's no film mag on it, it can be a smaller looking thing.
So that gives you flexibility.
There's some flexibility there, for sure.
Think,
yeah, and with Ball Don't Lie, we actually shot Super 16 because we wanted to shoot most of the movie handheld. So
you did the whole thing in Super 16?
Yeah, so shot it lighter. You know, the idea was lighter, more mobile. Yeah.
And tell me about the editing process. Do you have any say in that at all, or do you sit by the editor? What do you get to do?
No, I mean, with most of all of my films in recent memory, I've worked with the same editor. So it's this guy, Steve Pilgrim, who's amazing, and he cuts a lot of docs. And so he kind of knows the stuff, like knows what I like aesthetically.
That's sweet.
And so he'll go through and kind of steal stuff. And then he'll do a first pass for me, like an assembly or a rough cut. Mm-hmm. And then I'll go through and watch it, and we'll talk about ideas and talk about moments. But he is really like a master of finding the best performance moments, and then also those little quiet moments that I was talking about that I like to steal. Like he just is genius.
That is so
at that
lucky
stuff.
That you have him in your artillery.
No, it's
as
great.
It were.
He's amazing.
And then, do you also sit through like the post, like the coloring when somebody
all
goes
of it? Yeah,
you sit through.
I'm there for every hour of coloring and every hour of sound, like mixing and all of
that. Does everything have to be not dubbed over, but how do you say? Does everything have to be ADR'd?
No, I mean we didn't have a ton of ADR. We had some ADR where Joss like wanted to rewrite lines, you know, in post.
Oh,
where there's just,
oh
like,
interesting.
He's like, I don't really like how that's sounding. So there was a couple of those things, but very few. And then some of the things where there's just like a mic bump or, you know, one word in the movie we forgot to record because the movie is strange. Like people are always off camera.
Yeah.
You know, like the movie takes place 2,500 miles apart from each other. So mm-hmm. the characters are in two different environments. Yeah. And for the entire show, they were in the same environment for acting. Like, you would have one actor under the table.
Oh, wow.
Like, hiding or in the refrigerator or, like, under the bar in the bar scene or, like, in the back of the car or wherever. Like,
feeding each other the lines.
Yeah, because you need that emotion. And so it's not that different than sort of being over the shoulder.
Yeah, yeah.
You understand filmmaking out there and story.
Sure, eye lines and the actor.
Yeah, eye lines and all
somebody.
That. And
sure.
Sometimes you don't always, your eye line isn't always, you're not always looking at them. You're looking at some mark on the camera over there at the wall.
And sometimes, like, big time actors will famously, like, if they're generous, they will stay when they are not on camera and act with the other person.
Them,
and if they're not, they just leave and you're acting with a guy with a script in his hand.
And so we actually didn't even have that problem because in every scene, these two were there for each other,
that's
which is
awesome.
Amazing. And except for one word, which we then forgot to record.
What was the word?
Bimbo. Penis. No, I'm sorry. Bimbo.
Bimbo. Well, at least it was a good
Bimbo.
Word. And the film takes place in New Mexico and New Hampshire. So you shot in both places?
We shot in New Hampshire half of – we shot 21 days and I think 9 days were in New Hampshire and the rest of the days were in L.A. for New Mexico.
Yeah.
You can see in
and
your
plane,
eyes right
trains
now.
Trains and automobiles in the movie. So there you
oh,
go.
Good. I
it's
love
crazy.
Transportation.
Crazy.
Sure.
You love transportation.
You guys can see this right now. It's a Vimeo distribution. It's only $5. So if you can – you can look up Bryn Hill. You can look up In Your Eyes. Yeah. You can look up Joss Whedon. What?
I'm sorry. I'm not – from what I read, it was only for 72 hours on Vimeo when it first opened.
No, no. So it's on the website, inyoureyesmovie.com, and you can rent it. Your rental is for 72 hours. So
sorry. I misunderstood.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. You were right. I just wanted to make sure
Powered by Vimeo. So,
powered by Vimeo.
So you can find it at our website.
You can find it. I was wrong, and Christine was right.
Oh, my gosh. Say that again. What?
I was
By the way, I had a Saab, and I spent a lot of time at the Sherman Oaks Saab dealership. In fact, I had like a second office over at the Sherman Oaks Saab dealership, and I would tell my buddy Dan, who I was working with, just swing by Saab, and we'll hash it out.
It's true.
And
that
he's like,
Saab,
are you in your
Saab
regular place? And I'm like, yeah.
A cantankerous little vehicle.
I know, but I do love how the key is in the central
it's
console.
It's pretty awesome.
That's very
I
hot.
Loved my Saab, but I did not enjoy fixing it all the time.
It's a Saab story.
It's a Saab
wait, now
story.
That you
There's
are,
a hip-hop song called
now
Saab
that you,
Story spelled the same way.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Is the concept by Dwayne?
I wish. It's by Leaders of the New School for all you hip-hop fans out there.
Oh, wow. You're so white. Did you say that? you're very Opie, you know, Opie and Anthony.
Not Opie and Anthony, no. And now that you are a more successful man, what are you still driving a Saab, a newer Saab perhaps?
No, you know, I was driving my Saab station wagon recently, but then I turned it in for a Prius.
Oh, that's all right. I think, you know, I honestly...
But I do love never getting gas.
The whole hybrid idea, it makes so much sense to me.
It's pretty awesome.
It seems like every house should have at least one hybrid vehicle. Is that
that's
so much
what, that's
to
what
ask
my
America?
10-year-old daughter tells me.
Well, see, that's... At heart,
she says,
I am
we're
10.
Saving polar bears, Dad.
Hey, you want to play some Shotgun Storyworthy?
Yeah, man. Let's do it.
It can only mean one thing. It's time for Shotgun Storyworthy.
The game where our storyteller spins the Storyworthy Wheel of Truth and tells a true one-minute story about the topic it lands on.
So everybody, say it with me.
Spin that wheel!
Dad. All right, so I lived in Boston. I went to prep school, but I didn't live in the neighborhood where all my friends lived. So I went down to play Little League. My dad took me down to try out, and they were like, the sort of jerk guy who ran the Little League was like, you can't play here because of your address. I was like, I can't play with my friends. So my dad was like, forget this dude. It was a whole thing, like a back and forth. He was like, forget this dude. And he marched me down to this Little League that was next to the projects. And he was like, and I was like, this is a scary neighborhood. Like, I don't know. These kids are intimidating. And he was like, no, you're going to play for this. It's going to change your life. So I played for the North Cambridge Little League Reds on Ringe Ave at Ringe Field. And it changed my life. Like, it literally, I wrote my college essay about it. Like, it was the most multicultural, cool team ever because there were kids from the projects and working class kids. And we ended up winning the championship. And I ended up making the all-star team. And we went back and we kicked West Cambridge's ass, and it was all thanks to my dad.
There you go.
A script. I think you got a script right there. Bad news baseball players.
It's the bad news baseball players.
bad news.
Boston, yeah.
But
yeah,
they were all like the sweetest kids. Like,
did they make fun of you? No.
No. Like, that team was like super multicultural. There were Irish kids, Italian kids, African-American kids, Puerto Rican kids.
So
like,
you didn't stand out.
Well, I stood out in the sense that I was this kid who was like going to prep school, but I kind of lived in this neighborhood. So I sort of knew some of the kids from like sports and stuff, but there was one kid who's now the head coach, basketball coach at Cambridge Orange and Latin, named Lance Doughton, and he doesn't even know this. He probably doesn't even remember this. But he was this huge athlete. He ended up playing football at Michigan. And the first day of practice, I was like really nervous, and he came by and he was like, I know that kid. That's Bryn. He's really nice. Nobody touch him.
Wow.
And literally, like, because of that, like, I had this pass. Like, I could go there. No one ever bothered me.
That's fantastic.
And it was awesome. Yeah. It was like, and he has no idea, like, how he affected my life. But well, the thing was, I got
Facebook.
To know all these amazing
yeah,
kids.
Yeah, well, no, we're
going
to have
team.
To tag him in our
yeah, is he on
thing.
Facebook
so
or what?
I don't know. I don't know if he
let's
is.
Tell him.
Lance
let's
Doughton.
Tell him that you've been to Wayne's house and you know. Listen,
but
by
no,
the way,
but no, seriously. I mean, the thing is, like, being on that team, I'd learned all these different stories about all these different kids who came from all these different places. Like, some of them were immigrants. Like, there's Jamaican kids. And it made me want to tell stories that were different, that were off the beaten
That's
path.
Beautiful.
And it kind of made me want to be a filmmaker and a storyteller.
How
so,
old were you then?
I was 8.
Whoa, really? You were 8 years old?
8 years old, and I played on that team 8 to 12.
Now, you have children now. You told me you have a 10-year-old and a 7-year-old and a baby. And so do you ever want to just take that 10-year-old and drive him out to South Central and say—
Well, not South Central, but she plays on a multicultural basketball team outside of her neighborhood because their school is predominantly white. Like,
right.
And so I'd want to give her a different experience, like just experience kids from different walks of life, different backgrounds, because that's the thing that was so cool about it was like just opened up my world.
Yeah, it opened your eyes.
I mean, my neighborhood was multicultural, the neighborhood I lived in, but it was like so I was this weird kid who was sort of an outsider at prep school and sort of an outsider here. But it made me a storyteller.
Wow.
And it made me have sort of empathy for everyone, I think.
How long did you stay on that team?
4 years.
That's a long time.
Yeah. I mean, kids would cycle out based on age, but there are always new stories. And then I became one of those kids.
So your 10-year-old's a basketball player. What about your 7-year-old?
7-year-old's a soccer player. She's
soccer.
Really good.
Interesting. And now you have a little boy.
Now I have a little boy that just is a crawler.
A crawler.
Yeah, he's a professional crawler.
So he's going to be a wrestler.
Yeah, he's really good at crawling.
And the biggest difference between the boy, girl, and the baby girl. Wait a minute. And the biggest difference between a baby boy and a baby girl is when you change the diaper. Am I right?
You don't want to be.
As far as I can tell, yeah, but that hasn't happened.
You haven't had that arch of pee come
right
at
your head?
No,
he's like really good, man. This kid's like the chillest, mellowest Zen baby. He's super happy all the time, and he smiles all the time.
What's not to be happy about?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a good
But I mean, he's a redhead, so who knows what'll happen, you know?
Aww.
He's a ginger.
I think that's adorable. Your little girls don't have red hair, though.
They don't.
Interesting.
Yeah, we're all over the map.
I love it. Have you
fun.
Seen a mailman lately? What does he look like?
Oh,
she.
Seriously? Wow. Hey, it's Hollywood, baby. We don't judge.
Hey,
we don't judge.
I can't thank you enough for coming in, Bryn.
Thank
Hill.
You for having me, guys.
Really,
yeah, that was
so
awesome.
So much fun to talk with the director and to get some background, because usually we have writers on the show and actors. We don't usually have this caliber of...
we usually don't have anybody with any power, so it's really nice to kiss your ass.
We don't have these sort of powerful people on our show. We have more the talent angle of things. So this was Trent...
we
fantastic.
All hand each other headshots, and then we use them to dry our tears.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I hearing about your flaccid sob, I mean, that's...
Oh, now see, we're trying to be nice
long.
To him.
He's the one that said it.
It was just lipping along.
And I hope you have a lot more genius meetings.
I hope so too. They're awesome.
They're not a bad thing.
I actually love them.
Yeah. How could you go wrong?
No, I was like, if anyone out there wants to have a genius meeting, let's do it.
I say that too. I'm like, you guys want to hear what I have to say? I'm there. I'll
let's
come.
Do it. I'm in.
I'm in.
We do throw the word genius, like the genius bar at the Mac store.
I have noticed though that I get less genius comments than I used to. So
oh, do you really?
Maybe that's good.
Maybe that's just changing. You know, like things just kind of change the
because kids are so smart and we're getting older.
That was like 8-10 years ago you had the genius meetings, and it's like 10 years ago in show business is a million years in terms of whatever the buzzword
right,
is for today.
I haven't figured out what the new one is, but
I think it's Netflix. That might be the new buzzword.
You're such a Netflix.
You're such a Hulu Plus.
No, streaming. You're a streamer.
You're a streamer, I say.
Your genius streams out of you for
$7.99. All
soon
right,
to be $8.99.
We are going to wrap it up right about now. I'd like to thank everybody here at Sideshow Network, including Sean Merrick and Anthony Bench. And, of course, John Thomas Griffith. You know, that's the guy that wrote the theme song, Follow Me.
He did write that theme song. I've never heard it. Oh, wait, that's our song? Never mind.
That's our song. Okay. It's playing right now.
Is it playing while we're talking?
And on behalf of our storyteller tonight.
I need help.
Bryn Hill, tell everybody up on the 11th floor we said hello. If you go up and talk to your manager, you say, those peons down in Sideshow Network on the 6th floor, they say hello.
What if the 11th floor is just a bunch of empty space and it's just a mysterious, like, you can't come up here? It's all a show.
We'll never know.
We'll never know. It's true.
And on behalf of you, Hannes Finney, my dear friend and co-host, my name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a story-worthy week.
I was wrong. Christine was right.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years, one of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.